I just want to give you a little heads up about the upcoming series. So today we begin week one of our Finding a Meaningful Life series. Excited about this. It's a two-parter. Vince is going to come up in a little bit and kick that off. But in, so three Sundays from now, actually, no, it'd be two Sundays from now, we begin this new series, Learning to Control Your Inner Asshole. If that offends you, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Kind of not really sorry. This is unfortunately something that every one of us watches and experiences on a daily basis. Now, whether it's something inside of you or it's something inside of someone you live with or someone you work with, something happens, something's said, something's done, bad experience on the way to work, and all of a sudden, a new thing starts to form in one's mind, and then it makes its way to their tongue, and you start saying, perhaps, and doing things you really, in your best moment, don't want to be saying or doing. And that is a problem. We see it as a colossal problem here at Friends because we believe that really our spirituality, all that we do in this journey of ours that we call the spiritual journey, is about being able to control this thing so that we can actually love our neighbor better. We see Jesus' command to love God and love your neighbor as kind of the quintessential measure. So there is no greater thing that we hear. Sometimes I'm out in the lobby on a Sunday morning and someone walks in the door, couple, and the husband who's come in dragging, kicking and screaming, not wanting to do the church thing, but is coming out for the first time, and his wife's like, I want you to meet me, you know, blah, blah. So it's like, hey, hi. So you're coming in today. And when we hear a guy say, I don't know what you're talking about, but I'm watching the change in this person that I've been married to for the last 12 years. And I can't deny, she's becoming someone that is really remarkable. So I don't know what you're talking about here, but I said, I'll give it a shot. There's no greater thing that we can hear because that is the ultimate measure of the spiritual journey. So we're going to take 2 weeks to talk about some of the inner gears that crank up that guy or that girl. I shouldn't be sexist in this. It's probably just a it, but it can come out, and we want a more mindful community, don't we? Everyone, get over your offense at that and hear what we're saying, right? We need to control this thing. So anyways, on that note, you have an opportunity to keep it in check as you smile at everyone. We're going to take a coffee break. You can grab a coffee and you can small chat with someone beside you, or you can just be quiet and relax. We're going to get going here right away. Enjoy your morning, everyone.
Morning, everybody. How many of you have had a moment driving home from dropping your kid off at some sporting event, going to the grocery store, ordering your 6,000th cup of coffee at the Starbucks, you know, fill in whatever blank and thought to yourself, what is the meaning of this? Like, we spend so much time in our lives doing all these random things. You gotta ask yourself at some point, like, is this valuable in any way? Does this create a meaningful life? Because really, you have to do them, right? Your kid's in soccer, you need to taxi them to soccer. You have to go to work tomorrow, or what if you work tomorrow? You have to go to whatever meeting. You have to do all the things you need to do. But the question is, what makes a meaningful life? And when you sit with that question, it's kind of daunting, isn't it? Because even as I ask what makes a meaningful life, my brain kind of goes a little bit blank. Which is even worse, because now I don't even know what a meaningful life is, right? You guys are looking at me going, you know the answer, right, Clausen? You're going to tell us in 20 minutes, right? But I think every one of us at some point has to sit with that question, what makes a meaningful life? You have to dig down into all the things you do, all your dreams, all your goals, your values, all the stuff you do, and go, what makes this meaningful or not meaningful? The fascinating thing is, actually, our spiritual tradition, the Christian tradition, they talk a lot about this. Not in the way we do, because let's be honest, we have so much spare time right now that we can obsess about the meaning of life. We're not worrying about starvation and, you know, dying at the hands of our slave overlords or, you know, whatever famine's going to come across the sea to us. We don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. It's pretty nice. But it does make us ask the question and have to dig deeper to ask the question, what makes life meaningful? So in the Christian tradition, there's actually two stories, because that's how they captured meaning. They would tell stories. There's two stories that I think apply to this question from our tradition that I want to explore today. And as I go through them, I want you to ask yourself, does this create meaning in my life for me? And the first one's a fascinating story. You probably know it, of the garden in Eden, right? I was studying the story. Did you know that the garden is in a country named Eden? I didn't know that. I learned something new this week. So there's a garden in Eden that we'll also call Eden, so that just makes sense, right? We remember it. There's two people who are living in Eden according to this story. Adam, which is short for Adama, which means mankind or people. And Eve, which means mother of all. So you can take the story really literally, and I'm okay with that. Or you can take it metaphorically, as the names kind of suggest. You know, mankind and the mother of all get together, and they're having a party in a garden in a country named Eden. And everything's fine and good. They're naked, which is awesome. And the character God comes to them in the story and says, you guys get to do whatever you want in here. You can eat from whatever you want, just not that tree. What tree do you think they're thinking about all day long? What tree are they thinking about as they're trying to go to bed at night? Ooh, I bet you the fruit of that tree is like wicked good. So after weeks of obsessing over this tree that they're not supposed to touch, a snake comes to them. Now, snake in this story talks, of course, as snakes do, right? Snake is also something bigger. In our culture, or in evolution of humans, snakes is a really important part of our evolution, it's suggested. As we were kind of living in trees as earlier ancestors, one of our biggest predators are big snakes. And so one of the reasons why we see color so clearly and so well, it's thought, is because we needed to detect snakes on the tree branch so they didn't eat us. So the most scary thing in all of the world shows up and talks to the man and woman, mankind and mother of all. And of course, the snake, being the wily little bugger he is, says, okay, I know God says you're not supposed to eat of that tree, but really, why? And Eve says, well, God says that then we'll die. And he's like, really? I bet you this fruit's just really tasty. And I bet you it's really awesome. And I bet you if you eat that fruit, you're going to get all the things that God doesn't want to give you. Because I think God's being a little stingy here, don't you think? And of course, the inner victim in all of us shows up in this story and is like, yeah, that's brutal. I can't believe we can't eat that fruit. And so what do? They eat the stupid fruit. And the story says we have the first moment where something breaks. Later, people will say it's sin entered the world in that moment. But let's be honest. If they hadn't have done it, we would have done it, right? It might have got to my generation, but then I would have been the one eating the fruit because I was like, really, that fruit looks awesome. And so we have this story of a perfect world and then this moment of like weird, don't eat a fruit, and then I want the fruit because you told me not to eat the fruit and now I'm obsessed with it. And then the snake comes and says, well, you're a victim for not getting the fruit. And so now we eat the fruit and there's this break, the story says. The snake is cursed to crawl in its belly from that point forward. Men and women suffer. Life is hard. It's like the world and humanity are at odds with each other. They're fighting each other. The idea is that sin entered the world. Something broken entered the world. God and humanity no longer connected. Now just sit with that story for a second. This is the story I grew up with. And ask yourself, does this make a meaningful life? The joke growing up was, all humanity is worms and dirt. We're just useless, right? We're as good as a worm or as dirty as the dirt. There's nothing redeeming about us. We're no value at all. We just need to like wait till the end and hopefully get off this spinning rock and go to heaven or not go to hell. Does that feel like it creates a meaningful life? There's a second story. So we have the Garden of Eden story. This story is actually just a little bit earlier. So it starts the Bible. The Bible is named, or the first book in the Bible is called Genesis, which is the Hebrew word Bereshit, which means in the beginning. So this is like the very beginning of the whole thing. And again, I don't take this literally. If you do, that's cool. But this is how the story starts. All was chaos, and the Spirit of God floated over the chaos and said, let there be light. Now, has anyone ever had pulled an all-nighter? You know, for school or for lots. Insomnia, you know, your kid screaming all night and you're just waiting for the sun to come up. When that first rays of the sun come up, you're just like, oh, sweet mother, it's so beautiful. You know that feeling? You get up early in some beautiful place, you watch the sunrise. Why are we obsessed with this? Because when they see the sun, we all look at it and go, that's good. Whatever that sun coming up is, that's incredible, isn't it? And the story in Genesis says, God saw the light and went, oh, that's good. Isn't it cool? After the sun comes up, it says God separated the water from the earth, or from the land. I'm thinking he made Hawaii with all the beaches, right? Or some tropical place, right? Because you've ever been on a beach in Hawaii? Tell me that beach isn't beautiful. The separation of water and land and waves coming in and sand. God saw that and said, oh, that's good too. That looks really good. You go through event after event. We have water separation from land, the beginning of vegetation, flowers, greens, trees. Tell me that's not good, huh? God saw the flowers of the world and said, yeah, that's good. On and on, animals. Then there's this weird part in the between where if you're a literalist, this gets a little tricky because we have all this and then all of a sudden God made the sun and the moon and the stars. Just bear with it. But have you ever sat on a clear night, often when it's cold, in the middle of nowhere, and looked up and saw the stars? I was in Idaho a couple years ago on this motorcycle trip, and I had to get from one place to the other. I went over a pass, and all of a sudden I turned off my bike, and it's like dead black. And I just sat there looking at the stars. I probably was up there for 15 minutes. The number of stars out there blew my mind. And like all of us, God saw the stars and said, it's good. Then it says God made mankind, Adama. And it says God made all of it, the little babies as they first smile and laugh at you. Little kids who run at you with this joy in their eyes of like playing is the funnest thing in the history of the entire world. You know, the awkward adolescent says they're just trying to figure out who they are. But they have this kind of cultish beauty and awkwardness and growth. Teenagers and all their, like, perfect bodies and everything's perfect about them. 20-something-year-olds who have, like, the power of the world behind them. They're just, like, ready to challenge anything. The 30-somethings is they build the world around us. The 40-somethings who build the world even more, but they do it smarter. Because the 30-somethings sometimes, you know, enthusiasm, right? The 40s go, wait, I'm going to do this better this time. The 50-somethings, who look at this world and there's this kind of like, look what we've built. They have this confidence, this, you know, even their sexuality is confident. The 60-somethings who have wisdom that 60 years is going to bring you. The 70-somethings who stand in front of everyone and go, this is what wisdom looks like. The 80-somethings who go, I can't even believe living to 80-year-old, but you're doing amazing. All the people, all the generations, God saw all this and said, damn, that's good. From the very beginning to the very end, it's all good. You're good. The core of each one of every one of us, you're good. Can you feel the difference in the two stories? If you start the Bible two chapters in at the Garden of Eden, it's a story of shame. A story of feeling embarrassed and guilty and less than. To me, and this is just me, I don't find purpose there. But when I start the story at the beginning, and I look at each one of us, look you in the eye and say, you're good. You're good. You're good. Something sprinkles in us, doesn't it? Something wakes up. What if each one of us is good? Look at the person next to you for a second. What if they're good? What if everything around us is good? Sure, we screw it up now and again, right? You duff it, you do something dumb, you make a mistake. Who cares? The core of us is good. The Adam and Eve story says the core of us is sinful and it's dark and it's broken. But the first story says, no. The meaning of life is found in going back to who we are at our core. The good inside of each of us. And then spreading that into the person next to us to help them find the good in them. To find that original good that's always been there. And then spreading that out into the entire world and saying, no, we're all going to elevate together. We're all going to be lifted up. What if that's what life's about? Finding our way back to the good that's in all of us. Developing that. Letting it spread out of us. What if that's the meaning of this life? That's not bad, is it? When I first started thinking about this, I was like, actually, yeah, I like that. But wait a second. Let me just try this. Who thinks the world's actually getting better? Who thinks the world's going to hell in a handbasket? It's fair, isn't it? It kind of feels like the world's going to the toilet, isn't it? Okay, so I read an amazing book by Steven Pinker. Let me just throw out some of his stats, but I want you guys to experience it a little bit. 1700s. How many of you are over 30? Just put up your hand for me. Yeah, you're all dead. The average lifespan was 30 years old. 30 years old. Is there anyone 30? Here you go. Two. You guys are going to be the only ones alive. Well done. Yeah, that's you. You're like, whoa, just me? Yeah, just you. Child mortality. 300 years ago, 1/3 of the children didn't make it to 5 years old. 1/3. There was a time for about a year and a half, half the world's population, half the children didn't make it to 5 years old. Right now, worldwide, the number is 6%. We went from 33 to 50% mortality to 6%. And in developing nations, it's even lower. And the poorest countries, their numbers are just ramping. Like, it's getting better and better and better. Isn't that incredible? Poverty. 90% poverty in the 1700s. Think about that. Like the first two rows, you guys have anything? The rest of you all are like starving to death. Right now, that number is less than 10% in the world. In the last number of years, we've dropped poverty by 20% worldwide by caring, by doing our best, all the different things we've done. Homicides. Even in the Wild West, but if you look back a little bit further, we've dropped it down to 3% of the homicides that used to be only 100 years ago. 3%. That's a lot of homicides. Me and Lindsay were talking. She had a pink shirt the other day. I was like, oh, your shirt looks great. She's like, oh, it's for Bully Day. I was like, oh, well, that's wicked. And I was just reading this book, and I was like, isn't it a beautiful world that we get to focus on bullying, not on vendetta killings that are killing our kids? Because back in the day, if you killed, I killed you, your family killed me and my family, in which case my family killed you and all of your family, and then you were sitting close to him, so we killed you too, and then your family, right? It was brutal. Okay, so here's the most brutal statistic. Only about 50 years ago, 60 hours a week was spent on housework. Isn't that just a horrible world? But think about that. 60 hours a week. That's 6 days a week, 10 hours a day on housework. Shoot me now. With the rise of electricity, running water, stoves, microwaves, you know, refrigeration, all the different things we do, that number's dropped to less than 15 hours a week. If that's not a sign the world's getting better, I don't know what is, folks. 86% of the countries over the last number of years have said we're getting happier every year. This world, on statistical whole, is getting better. Isn't it? I read this book and I was just like fist bump in the air, like, yeah, I love it. But the problem is right now, if anything happens to anyone in this world, I will get a video of it in my inbox within, like, hours. Right? Back in my dad's generation, the Great Depression, you knew what was happening in your family. Maybe it was happening a little ways. You didn't know what was happening across the world. You didn't care. A telegraph. We are not doing good. Well, that's not that useful for us. Our world is getting better. This idea that at the core it's all good and we're lifting it back to that good place, there's something to it. Now, there's still things we have to deal with. Bullying, me and Lindsay talked about a bunch. That's an issue we need to deal with. We need to figure out how to make this thing go away, how to protect kids and adults. But our world on a whole is getting better as we do it. It's a pretty cool thought, isn't it? Next thought then comes to, for me anyways, it goes to, okay, what can I do? In which case, I'd put up a Mother Teresa photo, right? And you're all going to be like, yeah, of course, Mother Teresa, geez. She's only like Jesus or something like that, right? No one can do that. So in 1970, there was 350,000 new cases every year of polio. When I was a little kid, in our church, we had a lady named Mrs. Pierce. She had polio. She contracted it when she was young. She had this shitty old wheelchair, like steel, with these motors like kind of strapped on that she could kind of drive around a little bit. But her mobility was brutal. She had a jack on the side of her car. Her husband would spend 15 minutes jacking her out of her wheelchair and getting her into the car after church every night. His full-time job was to make sure that she didn't die. She could do almost nothing. 350,000 new cases every year in 1970 of Mrs. Pierce. Isn't that brutal? In the last number of years, they've estimated that it cost $85 billion to support all the cases of polio we've had to deal with. And the price primarily has come from developing nations who don't have $85 billion to spend on it. 2016. How many new cases of polio have we seen? 40. $85 billion of savings just helping people. Not to mention 350,000 less 40 people per year not permanently paralyzed. Why? We figured out how to do a vaccine. And places or people like Bill and Melinda Gates and their Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation helped spread that vaccine over almost all the world. Two people. Now, they are the richest people in the world. Fair enough. But in their mind, you can see, I want a meaningful life. They were last estimated at $98 billion of value, or what they were worth. $98 billion, that's just a ridiculous number. I think I did the math. I'd have to spend $5 million every day until I die, and I'd still have money left over. Like, that's a lot of money. They could literally just go buy a country and then just do nothing. What do? They go, no. I want a meaningful life. I want 350,000 people, less people, being paralyzed for the rest of their life every year. That's what I want. I want a world that's better. I want the $85 billion that goes to support these people back into buying food for people who need food in countries that can't afford it. $85 billion, they could fly over McDonald's from here right to whatever country they have and have like the biggest party for a week, right? Here's what two people can do. Now, I know you're thinking I'm not Mother Teresa and I don't have $98 billion in assets. Fair enough. 1950, just after the war, Mexico was in a brutal place. This is before NAFTA and all that stuff. They don't have enough food. Their population's starving. It's just after the war, so they go to everyone, they say, can we buy some wheat? Can we buy anything? And it's just after the war, so no one's got anything to sell. People are dying off by starvation. It's insane. In walks a guy. His name's Norman Borlaug. Now, Norman doesn't have $98 billion. He doesn't really even have a Mother Teresa heart. But he's a geneticist. And so he goes to Mexico and he goes, what if we can figure out a way to feed people? What if we can use the training I've been given, the science that I understand, and what if we could figure out a way to feed more people? And he was there for about 12 years, 10 to 12 years. He figured out how to put a whole bunch of this. I'm going to wave my hands because I have no clue how this works. It's like the black box stuff, right? Like, he did cool things, and he figured out how to make 2 growing cycles per year. So now instead of having 1 crop of grain, they got 2. Then he figured out how to make those grain crops grow and produce more. But the wheat was growing too high and was falling over and then it wouldn't work. Again, I'm going to wave my hands because I don't know why it doesn't work, but supposedly wheat that falls over doesn't work. I don't know. So the wheat falls over. So he figured out how to make it shorter. Within 3 years, Mexico was exporting excess food because they had enough. And they had too much. Some have estimated that Borlaug, who again just went and did his best, has saved 1 billion people's lives over the last however many years. He saved 1 billion people's lives. If someone said, hey, I want to introduce Yannick. He's a great guy. Oh, by the way, he saved 1 billion people's lives. That's not a bad thing to have your life be about, right? 3 people who said, I want to have a meaningful life. One did it with kindness and generosity, Mother Teresa. One did it with wealth. And one did it with ability. Here's the thing. Each one of us can change that world, can change this world. Each one of us has the power to elevate this world. Now, some of us, it's going to be in, you know, Walter Borlaug and wheat and all that stuff. I don't know. It's probably not going to be me. But some of us, it's going to be at home with our kids. Some of us are going to be at work and just going, wait a second, yeah, I have my job, but I think there's something more meaningful I can do through my job. It's a class project in school, in high school or university, where instead of just not caring about the people around you, just trying to get a good mark, going, wait a second, how can we do this in a way that works for all of us? How does this bring us all back to that good state that the whole Bible starts with? You probably wondered why I called this message what I did. You know, you can do it, we can help. Anyone remember the old Home Depot slogan? I love that one. Whatever, they change it to something stupid. Whoever, if anyone knows any Home Depot like executives, tell them, go back to the old one. Because all this work that you're going to do, finding the good in yourself, overcoming the shame and the crap that you've dealt with and the stupid mistakes you've done, and going back, no, I'm good and I can do good things. Inspiring the people around you to do the same thing, and working with the entire world to bring it back to that good state. You can do it. We can help. We call this thing a spiritual gym for a reason, right? This is where you go and you do all the work out so that you can go do the real stuff in the world. We push you here. We inspire you. We teach you something new. We piss you off sometimes, right? I'll give you a hug after. I apologize. Right? But what we're trying to do is we're trying to find or get you back to the good inside of you. Get you past all the hang-ups and the ruts and the crap you're dealing with. And go, no, there's something good in me. I am good. And I can help the person next to me find the good in them. And I can do this with everything. You can do it. Friend Church can help. That's why we exist. That's the only reason we exist. To inspire you all to bring that world back to the good that is there from the very beginning. So that leaves us, as I wrap up, with a choice. Are our lives just things that the world has forced us to do? You know, drop your kid off at hockey practice after this hockey game? Hockey game. Sorry, buddy. He's going to kill it this afternoon. It can be just going to school because that's what you do, going to work, you know, putting in time, dealing with whatever, or it can have a higher meaning where you say, what is going to bring me back to the good place inside of me, the place that God saw in humanity and went, yeah, you guys are good. How am I going to let that spill out of me into the world around me? And supporting the people I love, the people who are struggling, help them elevate themselves to that good place. And let that spill out into the world around us. We have a choice. We can see our lives as just this crappy, you know, Garden of Eden. We sinned and we're all sinners and everything's sin and sin, blah, blah, blah. Or we can see ourselves as having a higher meaning. So today I want to leave you with this thought. What creates a meaningful life? I don't know that the story I told you today is the one, but it's one for me. And if you come here, we will do our very best to push you to find the good inside of you and let that spread out of you. And make this world a better place. Bring it back to its good. If you don't have a meaning, I'm saying that's a pretty good one. If you're asking, okay, how do I do that? How does this actually get played out? Jeff's up next week, and that's what he's going to talk about. Because ultimately, at the end of this thing, I want us to be able to all look at the world and say, it's pretty good out here. Have a great week, everyone. Stay warm. We'll see you next week.